culminating his first ever run for public office, you just heard a victory speech from the president-elect of the United States, Donald J. Trump. In his victory speech, he promised to serve all the people of all political parties, bring the country together, and revive the American dream. Alluding to his career as a businessman, he said, "What I did in business, I want to now do for our country, especially in the service of the forgotten men and women of our country, who will be forgotten no longer." Trump said he's going to embark on an ambitious program of rebuilding the country's infrastructure, putting millions of people back to work, and usher in an era of growth and renewal for the United States. NPR editor Domenico Montanaro is back with us. Domenico, we heard Trump name-check several of the political personalities who've been with him during this campaign. Does their stock suddenly rise in Washington, D.C.? The Rudy Giulianis, the Jeff Sessions, the Reince Priebuses.
Well, I certainly think you could see Rudy Giuliani play a significant role in a potential Trump cabinet. There had been one report that he could even serve as attorney general. He had served in the Justice Department previously. Wouldn't be a surprise if that's a job that Donald Trump will put him up for. But I think more importantly here, you saw Donald Trump try to reach out to those who didn't vote for him. He noted it was a hard-fought campaign. He expressed, he said, we should have Hillary Clinton, a major debt of gratitude for her service, that we need to bind the wounds of division, and that this is the time to come together as a united people, and that he pledged as president to serve all Americans. We'll see how he governs, what he winds up doing. This has been a Donald Trump who has at times been this Donald Trump, but at other times the person who would fire back if somebody said something mean or nasty about him. And we'll see. I would be shocked if over 4 years Donald Trump didn't also come out, whether behind the scenes or publicly, depending on who decides to take the fight to him. And if there are people, political opponents, who decide not to get in line, that's when you could see that Donald Trump. But for now, this was the tone that he probably needs to strike, especially in as polarized a country as we are.
If you've just joined us, that's NPR's Domenico Montanaro in Washington, D.C. You're listening to special coverage from KQED and NPR News. I'm Ray Suarez, and I'm joined by Scott Schaefer from KQED.
Domenico, after the 2012 election, the defeat of Mitt Romney, the party undertook this post-mortem and famously said that what they needed to do was really expand the tent and diversify the number of the kinds of candidates they run up and down the ticket, change their message to appeal to women, people of color. They did very little of that, and yet we have this resounding victory tonight by Donald Trump. What do you think is the takeaway for the party?
Well, I think they're as surprised as the rest of us, frankly, and they're not quite sure how this falls out, but they'll be happy with one thing. They're going to have unified control of the three branches or the three chambers of government and possibly the third branch of government if and when Donald Trump decides to appoint the Supreme Court justice who would tip the balance of the court to at least a 5-4 Supreme Court in favor of conservatives. So this is at least in that way, you have Republicans who are going to feel pretty good about being able to try to get their agenda through and repealing some of what they felt odious from President Obama, is most especially Obamacare and at least portions of Obamacare, what they do with the people who have gotten insurance under that system remains to be seen. There have been some efforts to replace. Demographically, though, you did see underneath all of this a significant share of Latinos come out to vote. In a place like Arizona, for example, you wouldn't have thought that Arizona wouldn't be called yet at this point. But that's where we are, leaning toward Donald Trump at this point, but much closer than in past years. So there is still going to be that for them to contend with, because I doubt that is going away. And remember, a lot of these traditional divisions that we've had can always snap back. You know, these parties are not static. American politics is not static. I've been telling people, remember in 2004, there were people writing books about a permanent red America. Then suddenly, with Barack Obama winning two elections, the first president to win 51% twice since Eisenhower, and everyone was saying there's no way Republicans can win again unless they diversify, and here we are.
All right, let's bring that's Domenico Montanaro, NPR's senior editor. Let's go to now to Sarah McCammon, who is in New York with Donald J. Trump, and quite a triumphant speech for Donald Trump, Sarah, and fairly conciliatory, certainly much more conciliatory than anything we've heard from him to date.
Yeah, a dramatically different tone from Donald Trump than what I've been hearing for more than a year on the campaign trail, and certainly from what I've been hearing in these final days of the campaign, which have been very intense and in which the rhetoric has been heated often, sounded almost like a different person. We did hear some of the same talking points about, you know, trade and immigration and making America great again, but no crooked Hillary references. In fact, he praised Hillary Clinton. He said that we owe her a debt of gratitude for her service. Completely different message and tone about Hillary Clinton and just overall tone.
Said he's going to seek partnership, not conflict, and make the country's infrastructure second to none. Of course, you have to do some of the math on the things that he's promised. I'm not sure it adds up. But nonetheless, it certainly got the attention of a very wide swath of the country in getting him to where he got tonight.
Is this a different place now, Sarah? It's Ray Suarez again. Steve Bannon, a man who had been living somewhat on the fringes of American politics, helping to run the Breitbart News website, became one of the leading figures in the Trump campaign. Has he been legitimized? Alex Jones, the host of InfoWars, one of the fringiest conversation programs generally distributed to Americans, dismissed as crazy by a lot of people. Donald Trump went on his show as a guest and praised him during that program. Is he legitimized? Is he brought into a new circle that defines where the parameters of American politics are now?
It does seem that way. I mean, you know, Steve Bannon, unlikely he's going away anytime soon. And Trump is the president-elect of the United States. And you know, these are the people that are in his inner circle. I have to say his speech tonight sounded a lot more like Kellyanne Conway, his pollster and campaign manager, who was brought in, as I'm sure you recall, to sort of appeal to female voters, to soften him a little bit. It sounded much more like Kellyanne Conway than Steve Bannon. And I was recalling as he was speaking many months ago, around the time that Ben Carson endorsed Trump, he talked about meeting with him privately and seeing a different side of him and how there were essentially two Donald Trumps. Kind of got a lot of flack for that. He was mocked for saying that a little bit. But it makes me wonder which of these Trumps is going to be president of the United States.
Well, and he also ran promising to settle scores if he got elected, with corporate CEOs and members of Congress, Paul Ryan. You have to wonder, was that just all kind of reality TV shtick?
Yeah, you do wonder that. And again, you heard in the speech tonight, not exactly an explicit promise not to do that, but a promise to be president for everyone and to work together with all American citizens, and just this sort of inclusive, bringing everyone in kind of tone. But yes, he has run that kind of a campaign, and it's something that energized a lot of his supporters. At the same time, I talked to a lot of supporters who would say, yeah, he's an entertainer, so don't take anything he says too seriously.
On that very score, Sarah, you've been talking to the people who come to his rallies. You've been listening to his stump speeches for over a year now. This is a man who promised to bomb the expletive out of ISIS, a man who said that he would do a lot worse than waterboarding and bring back torture into the American system as we try to investigate terror threats. He said a lot of things that his audience ate up. Will they be expecting that now?
I think that's a really good question. And I think that will probably shape, I mean, his assessment of the answer to that question will probably shape a lot of what he does. I heard Ron Elving saying earlier that, you know, the House and the Congress might not want to mess with an investigation into Hillary Clinton. And yet, and I don't know, I can't make any predictions, but I can't help but think about how energized these crowds have been by that promise.
Sarah McCammon, I'm sorry to cut you off. We have to take a break. Sarah McCammon reporting tonight from New York. You're listening to live election coverage from KQED and NPR News.
That's Scott Schaefer out in San Francisco with Ray Suarez. I'm Tom Cran, Minnesota Public Radio News with Mike Mulcahy. We have just heard an acceptance speech or a victory speech by President-elect Donald Trump. And we still don't know if he won Minnesota or not. And it appears as though he didn't, but it's a very tight race. One of the questions we still have here in the state, it doesn't matter because he has the electoral votes, but.
Yeah, very close. Four counties still not reporting any votes. And that really is why we still have this question mark at this hour. We do know that with the votes counted, 93% of the precincts reporting, Hillary Clinton has about a 35,000 vote lead, 47% to 45%. So that one still up in the air in terms of Minnesota. We know that Trump is the president-elect. Also, unresolved congressional races with 94% of the precincts reporting, and this is really the close one of the night. Tim Walz, the Democrat, 1st District Congressman, is leading by 28 votes over Republican Jim Hagedorn in the 1st Congressional District, the southern tier of the state. So that's pretty amazing. We don't know who the new member of Congress is in the 2nd District because the votes haven't come in yet. Jason Lewis, the Republican, has an 8-point lead right now over Angie Craig, but only 52% of the vote is in. And in the 8th District, Rick Nolan has a 51-49% lead over Stuart Mills. Nolan is the DFL incumbent congressman, Mills the Republican, 90% of the precincts in, and less than 6,000 votes separate those two.
Yeah,
so and we know Rick Nolan went to bed a while ago and said he'll call you in the morning, basically, let you know what happened. So we have to wait for these votes to come in. But I do want to bring Todd Rapp, our Democratic analyst, and Maureen Shaver, our Republican, in here, because it has not been a good night for Democrats in the state of Minnesota. Todd, you're the Democrat. Why don't you tell us what happened and why you think it happened?
Well, yeah, this is a presidential race, which is typically Democrats playing on the home field. And instead, they only took one seat tonight so far in the legislature. It's David Hand's seat, the Senate minority leader. We'll see what happens with the Dakota County seats that comes in.
So Republicans keep control of the state house.
Yes, and they're within one seat, I think, of taking control in the Senate.
Wow.
I think what it comes down to is, I don't think Hillary Clinton was as inspiring a candidate. Looks like voter turnout's going to be just a touch lower than 4 years ago. I think the Minshew issue in the last 3 weeks really hurt. I also think it hurt that there was no statewide candidate. If they had had Al Franken or Amy Klobuchar at the top of the ticket, it would have made a big difference. Add all those things up together, and it was a unique purple year for Minnesota.
Maureen, is that about how you see it?
I think Todd did a very nice job explaining why that is. I also think it's going to take a few days to understand how these Trump votes actually interacted with some legislative votes. There are some legislative seats that actually outpolled Trump in new territory for Republicans in Minnetonka and in some of the other areas. We're not sure in Dakota County what's happened yet. So I think we're going to spend a little time analyzing that. But I also think it is that check and balance that maybe Minnesotans are looking for check and balance. Governor Dayton is a DFLer, and the House will certainly stay Republican, and it looks like the Senate may pick up or be very close to being in the majority. And I believe it's the largest, actually, Republican election in a presidential year in Minnesota history. Hmm. So we're going to have to, it's going to take a little time to understand what that all means.
But it could be a rough final 2 years for Governor Dayton.
It'll be a very different year than what he was expecting, I think.
And we have to get used to this idea of President Trump, too, and what that will mean for the state. Todd, what's your first take on that?
I think we're going to spend the next few months probably seeing if there's going to be a transformation in President Trump. I mean, let's face it, he was very much a TV figure over the last year and a half, and now the policy issues are going to start coming forward. Mm-hmm. And I think we may see a very different man in a few months than we've been seeing during the campaign.
Sounds like we heard a slightly different, more than slightly different tone, conciliatory tone tonight in his speech and in the way he talked about Secretary Clinton as well. But now, Maureen, as we were saying off the air, he has to pick and build a government. So.
Yes. And, you know, clearly things resonated with the country, but Minnesotans also took a pause on him a little bit too. So we'll wait and see.
All right. Maureen Shaver, Todd Rapp, thank you very much. With Mike Mulcahy, I'm Tom Cran. Good night.
And we continue our election night coverage. I'm Scott Schaefer here at KQED in San Francisco with my co-host Ray Suarez from NPR. And we're talking with East Bay Congresswoman, Oakland Congresswoman Barbara Lee. And Congresswoman Lee, what are the next steps you'd like to see President-elect Trump take, or more importantly, President Trump, when he takes office?
The first thing he needs to do is to try to unify the country and to try to get people to understand that this divisiveness is un-American. And he needs to tone it down because, you know, in traveling the country, and I've been all over during this election, you know, people are fearful and, you know, he needs to reduce their anxiety, I think, and try in some ways to listen and try to not be as bombastic as he is, and you know, try to, if he can, to unify the country. I'm not sure he can because, you know, of his personality. But I also hope that he makes a clear statement about his national security strategy because his hand now will be on the black box, and he could trigger, you know, a third world war. And I'm terrified of that. And hopefully he'll say very clearly that he does not intend to do that, because during the campaign, we heard his statements, and they were very, very disconcerting.
Congresswoman, it's Ray Suarez from NPR. What happens to you who are in the Democratic congressional minority? Your party had high hopes for the Senate. There is a reduced Republican majority, but the Republicans are still in charge. Pretty much in the House of Representatives, things stayed where they were. What's the assignment for you? And as you head back to the next Congress, what do you think about the argument that the Democratic Party made to the American people? What do you have to change as you go forward?
Well, I think we need to do some soul searching. We need to debrief, and we're going to talk to each other and analyze what took place. It's pretty early to say, but I know some of us have got to resist what Donald Trump is going to put forward if, in fact, it's not good for the country. And so I know many Democrats will be part of a resistance movement if he lives up to what he has said during his campaign, because some of the outrageous statements about what he was going to do require us to push back and to let the public know that this is not acceptable. This is America. And even if he was supported by the Tea Party and the right wing and people who, you know, feel that others are threatening their existence, okay, well, he's got to say to everybody that he wants to be the president for everyone and not continue with this divisiveness.
Congresswoman Lee,
throughout this campaign,
one question before we let you go. What do you make of the fact that African-American enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton, there was kind of a rethinking of the Bill Clinton years during this campaign with the Black Lives Matter movement, especially among younger African-Americans? What do you make of that, and what's your takeaway for the Democratic Party in terms of its relationship with African-Americans going forward?
We have to see. I think, and I was in North Carolina, Ohio, Dayton, Ohio, Dayton, Ohio. I was in Davenport, Iowa, you know, at historically black colleges and universities. And many, many young African Americans wanted to hear more about the issues. You know, the campaign got bogged down in the negativity. I think that, I know black folks and African Americans are very smart voters,
And so we have to convince the, especially the millennials, that we stand for what they stand for. And when you look at the platform, and I helped draft the platform, it's a platform that speaks to the aspirations of everyone. We talk about affordability with colleges, debt-free education, supporting historically black colleges and universities, a formula that directs federal resources to targeted areas that have been in poverty for many years. So the platform speaks to the Democratic Party, which unfortunately people did not read and didn't, and the campaign did not use enough to let the African American community know that we're on this, on their side. But also, you have to remember now, again, going back to my psychiatric social work training, there's a lot of anxiety, separation anxiety taking place. You know, people are going to are bemoaning and really worried about not having President Obama and Michelle and the girls in the White House. So a lot of this enthusiasm gap I've been really looking at, because I've been talking to a lot of people around the country, and I think a lot of it has to do with letting go. You know, Barack Obama was a great president. He did so much in spite of the obstructionist Congress, and people know that. And so to see him leave is causing a bit of, depression, and people are not happy.
That's Representative Barbara Lee, Democrat of California. Congresswoman, great to talk to you.
Glad to be with you tonight on this very sad night, if you ask me.
We're now joined by Jessica Taylor, NPR political reporter. Jessica, you know, we've been talking so much about the presidential race, what caused the result, where the results came in from, that we haven't talked that much about the House and Senate. Give us an update.
Well, the Republicans obviously had a great night winning the White House, and they also had a great night in keeping the Senate and really keeping their losses in the House to just a bare minimum. Now, going in, the Senate was very much in play. Democrats had probably their best shot to flip seats. They were defending a handful of seats that were in these battleground states like North Carolina and Pennsylvania and New Hampshire. And as of now, it looks like they're only going to net one total seat, and that's in Illinois, where you had Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth that defeated Republican Senator Mark Kirk there. That was the one that we always thought was going to go. But you had places like Wisconsin that Republicans had counted out for months now, where Senator Ron Johnson held on to defeat in a rematch Russ Feingold there. And Democrats also, their really only other bright spot of the night was that they held retiring Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid's seat. They held that in their hands. So you have Catherine Cortez Masto that will be the first Latina elected to the Senate, but they ran the table. They kept really close races that were toss-ups going in North Carolina, in Missouri, and Pennsylvania. And the only outstanding race that we have right now that we don't know about is in New Hampshire there, that's too close to call.
Jessica, what are your thoughts about the leadership in the House and the Senate, especially the House? There was some discussion encouraging Paul Ryan not to hold elections right away. I think that was on the assumption that Donald Trump was going to lose. But does all that acrimony go away now?
Well, I think you will sort of see this kumbaya moment, because Republicans, they're riding very high. I mean, Republicans were always going to hold the House. They needed 30 seats in order to flip it. And Democrats thought that maybe they could get, 20, even 10 to 15. They're only, right now, they're only at 5 pickups. I mean, this is a disaster for Democrats on this level, too. And I think it mirrors, the tightening and, Republican surprises across the board based on the White House results as well. And so I think that, it will help Paul Ryan, because some of these members that we thought might lose were actually more moderate members as well. And so there was a concern that if the conference becomes more conservative, if those more centrist members and those swing districts were to lose, that he could face a challenge from the right. So I think this has certainly helped him. But then, he didn't have, the greatest relationship with Trump. So I think we'll have to see, do they mend fences? And I think that's a big test for Trump going in, as well. He certainly struck this conciliatory tone tonight too. How does that play with Republicans that weren't completely gung-ho for him over this campaign?
Jessica, quick question before we go. In the days approaching Election Day, Senator Charles Schumer, who was presuming, it sounded like he was presuming, that he was going to become the next majority leader. Nancy Pelosi leading her troops into battle, hopefully trying to get a larger minority in the House. after the failures of Election Day for the Congressional Democratic Party? Do they have to be looking at a new leadership team?
I think there will be a lot of soul searching on what went wrong. And, you know, you have seen Democrats, you know, lose seats with, Nancy Pelosi there. And, you know, I think there's was already even before that some, you know, push for, you know, new leadership and, you know, maybe, fresher, younger leadership in a way, too. But, you know, the thing, I mean, they're just as stunned. Both Democrats and Republicans are stunned by this. I can't underscore enough. You know, I was talking with a lot of my House and Senate governor sources on the Republican side in these past few days. None of them saw this coming. They really thought that they were probably going to lose seats. And not one single person I talked to said that their polling showed Trump even near winning. So, I mean, it's not just, you know, that the public polls were wrong in a lot of these instances. The private polls were really wrong, too. So I think that, you know, Democrats are certainly going to have to circle their wagon. They're going to have to look what happened, you know, with their analytics and with their polling. But I think that, you know, it is a question, I think, of some of their leadership as well and whether, you know, they need to regroup in a way.
All right. Jessica Taylor, NPR political reporter, thanks so much for joining us. Let me go back to Lisa Garcia-Bedoya from UC Berkeley. You were saying just before we brought in Barbara Lee that when you have a group of people, so many people feeling left behind, and then you add a racial component to it, it makes it even harder. What were you referring to? And I'm wondering also what impact you think the Black Lives Matter movement might have had and the police shootings in Dallas. I mean, all of that got kind of thrown into the pot right in the middle of this campaign.
Well, I think it helped fuel this white racial resentment. I think there was a sense that the conversation nationally was going in a direction that made people uncomfortable. And I think that fed into the kind of message that Trump had. But I think, and then the other part is, you know, the mobilization has to happen. But I think that the lesson here is really that you need ongoing shifts in terms of how we put our resources, how we run campaigns, and how these things work. And the other part, though, that I think it's important to think about and that I'm kind of going through in my head right now is, yes, you're going to have the House and the Senate and the White House all controlled by the GOP, but portions of the GOP that have very different policy positions, right? So if we think about the kinds of policies the senators want, you think about what the House wants, and then the fact that Donald Trump is advocating policies that are contrary to much of his caucus. It's interesting to think how that's all going to play out.
All right, let's go now to Nevada, which at one time we thought might be the state that decided the whole thing. It did go for Hillary Clinton, and they did hold on to Harry Reid's Senate seat, but Ilsa Chang is in Las Vegas tonight. And Ilsa, tell us about the new senator-elect there.
Catherine Cortez Masto is a former state attorney general here in Nevada. Her father, Manny Cortez, was a very, very close personal friend to Harry Reid. So that may have been in large part a reason why Catherine Cortez Masto was the hand-picked successor, hand-picked by Harry Reid. And he really threw his machine, his muscular ground operation, behind her. We saw massive get-out-the-vote efforts here in Nevada, especially during the early voting period the last 2 weeks. One of the large, or the largest union in Nevada, the Culinary Workers Union, thousands and thousands of members, more than half of them Hispanic, they led a huge voter turnout effort. They bused, there were huge busloads of, you know, these are the workers who are the housekeepers, the cooks, the kitchen workers in the hotels and casinos in Las Vegas. They were delivered by the busload to early voting polling places. There's, you know, wide perception that had a lot to do with Cortez Masto being able to pull out a victory. The one bright spot, in a way, for Democrats, besides Illinois, at least for the Senate map.
And a lot of the early reporting that was coming out of the election process in Nevada had to do with the get out the vote efforts and the mobilization of Latino voters. Can that be counted as a success? Even on a night where toting up the losses is a full-time job for Democrats.
Absolutely. I think the surge in Hispanic voters, particularly as we saw in the early voting period, that will be a story out of this election. You know, it's been here in Nevada, Hispanics comprise about one-fifth of all the voters. They have lagged behind into other races and ethnicities as a voter group. This year, and in several of the precincts with the heaviest Hispanic populations, we saw much greater voter turnout among Hispanics. I was just saying earlier tonight, you know, one of the viral images that went around last Friday, the last day of early voting here, was Cardenas Grocery Store. It's a Hispanic grocery store in Las Vegas. It was an early voting polling place. And in the last few hours of Friday, Hispanic voters were lined up around the building still waiting to get to vote. That has been an image that has flooded the internet and has been at least anecdotal evidence that Hispanic turnout really did surge historically, at least here in Nevada during the early voting period.
The photo of the Cardenas grocery and the size of the line was blasted out and tweeted out on social media networks across America and really filled Democratic sales that that Tuesday was going to be a good day for them.
In fact, it touched such a nerve with the Trump campaign. They tried earlier today on Election Day to try to get some of those votes set aside at Cardenas. They alleged that many of those votes had been basically, they were casted after the polls were supposed to have closed. The court, the Nevada State Court, did not agree with the Trump campaign's arguments, and that request was denied.
That's NPR's Elsa Chang in Las Vegas. I'm Ray Suarez in San Francisco. This is live election night coverage from KQED and NPR News.
And we continue our election night coverage. And as I'm sure you've heard by now, Donald Trump is the president-elect of the United States of America, edging out Hillary Clinton in a way that no one really saw coming, as we've been hearing all night. I'm looking at this map, and you've got not only Ohio in red, but Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Iowa, Florida, right across the country. Even Minnesota is only light blue. They haven't quite called that one yet. Arizona, probably going to end up in the Republican column as well. Lisa Garcia Bedoya, what do you make of where this leaves the Republican Party? Because going into it, there were already stories about finger pointing and recrimination and getting rid of leaders and how dare you not support Donald Trump. I mean, now what?
Well, everyone loves a winner, so I have a feeling they're going to be happy for a while, and now they have to figure out how to staff a government and have a transition. But I think the question of what the policies are going to be is a big one, especially because, and that's the contradiction tonight. So you have Senate candidates and House candidates winning on policy platforms that were very different from the top of the ticket. And how do we reconcile that when it comes to governance? And I think that's going to be the challenge within the Republican caucus.
And John Cohn, it's interesting that so many of the things Donald Trump ran against are quite popular with the American people.
That's
raising
right.
The minimum wage, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. And talk about climate change that was never discussed in the campaign and, you know, concern here in California and elsewhere.
Immigration reform.
So he'll have a huge challenge, you know, when it comes to the American electorate. You know, of course, we have to refine our polling methods to understand that even better, not only what happened on Tuesday night, but afterwards.
But along with the tremendous collection of data before the polls open, there's been a lot of collection of data when people were walking out. And I guess exit polling is a lot more reliable than pre-voting polling. You're a numbers guy. What can that be used for? What is that a source for as both parties try to figure out the way forward?
Well, and the exit polling, it wasn't more successful in predicting the outcome or helping to do that. But the main use of exit polling, and really the main use of good pre-election polling, is to understand help us understand the contours of the electorate. This is a major political moment in our country, and polling is what is going to help us understand it. Obviously, we have to refine our methodology and take a hard look at what happened on Tuesday, and you know the year of polling in advance of that. But it's through polling that we'll begin to understand what's happening.
The polling organization Latino Decisions predicted something below the Dole line of 21% for Donald Trump among Latino voters. Does that have to be taken to heart even when you're running up the score with white voters and winning a national election?
Well, and it looks by the map that Latino voters did turn out in large numbers. We talked about Nevada just a little bit ago. It is African-American voters in Wisconsin and Michigan that you know may have tipped the balance in Wayne County and Detroit.
All right, that's pollster John Cohen. We're going to continue our conversation from KQED in San Francisco and NPR News. This is live election night coverage. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Ray Suarez. Stay with us.
And you're listening to Minnesota Public Radio News. Good morning. It's 2:38. And while Donald Trump has been declared the winner in the race for the White House, it's still unclear whether he or Hillary Clinton won Minnesota. With 95% of the vote in, Clinton holds a 2-point lead
over Donald Trump. Good morning from Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Mike Moen. Meanwhile, some congressional races in Minnesota have yet to be called, namely the 1st Congressional District, where incumbent Democrat Tim Walz holds a very narrow lead over GOP candidate Jim Hagedorn. In the hotly contested 8th Congressional District, incumbent Democrat Rick Nolan holds a 2-point lead over Republican challenger Stuart Mills. In other congressional races in Minnesota, incumbents Eric Paulson, Benny McCollum, Keith Ellison, and Tom Emmer all won re-election. Meanwhile, DFL leaders have conceded the Minnesota House will remain in Republican hands. GOP House Speaker Kurt Dowd said Donald Trump's strong showing in rural areas helped in a number of state House races. But Dowd says Republicans held their own even in some districts that favored Hillary Clinton.
People were just energized. They don't want to see Governor Dayton have final 2 years of complete government control. And that's what he asked Minnesotans for. That's really what this election was a referendum on.
And among the DFL winners was the first Somali-American legislator, Ilhan Omar of Minneapolis. And again, keep it tuned to Minnesota Public Radio News throughout the early morning hours and into morning edition. We will continue to give you updates on what's happening here and also plenty of national reports on the nationwide election tonight. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Scott Schaefer from KQED right here in San Francisco, along with NPR's Ray Suarez. We continue our election night coverage. One of the things on the ballot in California today was we elected a new U.S. Senator, Barbara Boxer, the retiring Democrat. There were two Democrats vying to replace her. The one who won is Attorney General Kamala Harris, won handily over Orange County Democratic Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez. Let's hear what Kamala Harris had to say.
I believe this is that moment in time that many of us in our personal lives have faced, when we had to look in a mirror because of circumstances and a situation. We had to look in a mirror, and with furrowed brow, we asked a question, who are we? I believe this is that moment in time for our country. In California, I believe the answer is a good one.
Joining us again is Jessica Taylor, NPR's political reporter. Jessica Taylor, Kamala Harris is a fairly young Democrat from California compared to the other leadership we've had. Jerry Brown, Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Boxer, Nancy Pelosi. She is a rising star in the Democratic Party. What is she going to find when she gets to Washington?
Well, I think she's not going to be joining as many Democrats as she probably thought she was going to be, and as many women either. You know, in some of these other key races in Pennsylvania and North Carolina, we really thought that women would reach a record number in the Senate, and it doesn't look like that's going to happen either. But, I mean, she does bring, you know, with both, you know, with Cortez Masto being elected in Nevada, the first Latina senator, she is the just the second African-American woman ever elected to the Senate and the first in 20 years, and she is half Indian and half African-American, but she brings more diversity certainly to the caucus. And, you know, this was, she was the front runner this whole race. You know, of course, the interesting jungle primary you all have there, it was the race between her.
Made in California.
Yes, and Loretta Sanchez. And, you know, Sanchez had hoped to appeal to, you know, Republicans and more moderate. She's, you know, she's more conservative than Harris on issues like gun control and national security. But, I mean, Harris had the whole entire Democratic establishment behind her, from President Obama to Elizabeth Warren to Boxer, who she's looking to succeed. And, you know, she's been on their radar for a while. And I think you will see, you know, especially with not as many Democrats coming to the Senate as they thought, she can, I think, you know, be a new, younger, a more diverse voice that they can certainly point to as, you know, they're trying to dig themselves out of this election that they did not see coming.
You know, the label rising star was attached to her even before she had risen. What is it? Help people who are not familiar in other parts of the country with Kamala Harris understand what the buzz is about her and why she's so attractive and you know, seen as a comer, as somebody who's being groomed to Zoom.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, she did, for Democrats, she did a very good job there as Attorney General. And, you know, I think they just see her as someone who is, you know, very progressive on a lot of issues and, you know, has a very good, I think, you know, command of talking about a lot of the issues. You know, she's spoken at the conventions and things too. And, you know, I think they really sort of see her as a rising voice, you know, on some of these, you know, justice reform, criminal justice reform and things like that. So I think that, you know, you can sort of see her, I think, being a leader on that in the Senate as well.
There are a couple of models for senators like that, new senators, Elizabeth Warren, who kind of came in gangbusters, and then Hillary Clinton, who really said no to all the morning talk shows over the weekends and did her work quietly and built up a lot of credibility with her colleagues. What kind of a mood do you think this Senate will be in to face a rising star in the Democratic Party? What advice would you give her?
Well, I think that, you know, again, as you mentioned, you know, she's been built up for so many years that, you know, we assumed that, you know, she was either going to run for Senate or for governor. And, you know, sort of the national stage, I think, is ripe for her. You know, it seems like Elizabeth Warren is someone that she sort of sees as a mentor, I think. You know, Warren has been a big backer of hers. So I would expect her to sort of go more of that route. And, you know, as I said before, I think this is a Senate that needs younger blood, needs newer blood, and that I don't think that, you know, some of these such few new senators coming there, they can't really afford, I think, for them to sort of take a back seat right now. I think they're going to have to be aggressive and, you know, get themselves out there and try to put out a different message to contrast a Trump administration and a Republican-held Senate and House.
All right. Jessica Taylor, NPR's political reporter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Let's go
now quickly to Jackie Speer, Democratic congresswoman from the Bay Area south of San Francisco. Congresswoman Speer, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
This has to be a very bitter night for you and other women in Congress who worked so hard to get Hillary Clinton elected. Tell me what you're thinking tonight.
Well, I'm thinking that we lost. We lost big time. And it's important for us to go back and rewrite the political science textbooks. I mean, how could the polls be so wrong? How could, you know, we always have been taught that ground game is where it's at. Hillary had just a rock-solid ground game. Twice as many people were contacted around the country by the Clinton campaign as by the Trump campaign. Superior techniques and strategies used, and it fell flat.
Was it just Clinton fatigue, do you think?
Pardon me?
Was it just sort of Clinton fatigue or Democrat fatigue? You know, it's rare a party wins three presidential elections in a row.
I do think that there is fatigue in this country in terms of anyone who's been elected over a long period of time. You know, dynasties are out. The Bush dynasty fell flat very early in the cycle. The Clinton dynasty, I think, survived in part because, you know, Democrats are more supportive of that, you might argue, and she came out of the chute with just overwhelming support. Although Bernie Sanders did an outstanding job.
Did a very good job in California, won almost half the vote.
Captured a great deal of interest. You know, even I've been talking to high school groups in the last week or so, and I spoke to 900 of them. Just today. And it was surprising to me when I asked how many are voting for Trump, how many for Clinton, and a lot of them didn't raise their hands. I said, well, who are you all supporting? So Bernie Sanders. I said, well, Bernie's not a candidate. But, you know,
and I couldn't let go. Still feeling the burn.
I think we need to appreciate that as well.
All right.
But, you know, the Civil War was far more divisive than this election will be, and we're going to have to come together.
All right. Okay. Congresswoman Jackie Speer, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. We're getting short on time, but I want to talk about several ballot measures. There were several states, not just California, that had medical marijuana or recreational marijuana. There were 9 states in all. Marisa Lagos from KQED is here. How did those measures do around the region? Because there was Nevada and Arizona and then a couple in New England. How did they fare? David Downs, let me ask you that question. You're the new cannabis editor, and that's a thing, a cannabis editor with the San Francisco Chronicle.
That's right, Scott. Thanks so much for having me down. Yes, there were 9 ballot initiatives across the country, and 8 of 9 passed on this election night or are projected to pass, with the loser being Arizona. So California passed recreational legalization. Florida, a state of 18 million, added medical marijuana to its rolls. And then a couple other smaller states added recreational legalization as well, including Nevada and Massachusetts, as well as Maine.
And California wasn't close. I mean, it was called very early by AP.
That's right. The Associated Press did exit polling that had them so far enough ahead that they called it literally just as the election night parties were just beginning around 8 o'clock, and it's been pulling at about 55%.
What happens now? Now that marijuana, recreational marijuana, is legal in California, what changes?
Well, a big question everybody has for me is, when can I go buy it in a store? And that would be set to happen sometime after January 1st, 2018, when the state is under a deadline to begin issuing licenses. Personal freedoms do begin immediately. So at 12:01 a.m. on November 9th, you're free to possess up to an ounce as an adult, 21 and older, and grow six plants at your house.
David, as a political question and as a cultural question, when you look across these states, fully one quarter of the American population lives in the states that voted on marijuana today. Is this a turning point for the legal status of what is still classified by the federal government as a class one drug?
Sure. A lot of marijuana law reform activists think we're at that point, that California was sort of the drug war's Waterloo. And it certainly remains to be seen if the momentum continues. I know that cutting through all the election night celebrations was a real fear about what a Trump presidency is going to bring to the marijuana law reform movement. He's been in favor of states' rights, but he has also been in favor of law and order, and some of his deputies could potentially shift courses and take a different approach.
And David, what is this going to do to the price of marijuana, to the economics of it?
Well, in the short term, you could see price increases as regulations begin to bite down and there's some supply chain bottlenecks. But over the long term, experts think you could see the price of cannabis drop by as much as 90%, especially for the lower grade stuff.
In some ways, of course, marijuana was and is a medical question. And I want to bring in KQED's health reporter, April Domboski, because there were a number of health-related ballot measures in California, including condoms for porn actors, putting limits on what California can pay for prescription drugs, tobacco tax. April, kind of run through the ballot measures in California, how they fared tonight.
Sure. So the tobacco tax is the one that's poised to be the biggest winner. It looks like that is definitely going to pass. So Californians will be paying $2 more per pack of cigarettes. Prop 60, the condoms and porn, is not looking so good. Prop 61, drug pricing, also not looking so good. I think just based on some of the earlier polling, voters are just really confused about what they were voting on with the drug pricing one. And then we also had Proposition 52, which is looking like it will pass, that extends a fee on California hospitals that will support the Medi-Cal program.
As there are still places in this country where tobacco is lightly taxed, I want you to give people an idea of what a pack of cigarettes will cost in this state once that $2 per pack tax is added, roughly.
I think roughly.
She quit smoking a while ago.
I think we're going to be pushing toward $10 a pack, is my guess.
Wow, $10
a pack. Somewhere between 7 and 10.
David, it sounds like marijuana is going to be cheaper.
Possibly, and there certainly might be a new black market in cigarettes.
Wow. April, just as transitioning to Donald Trump for a moment, he, of course, has promised, as the Republicans have in general, to repeal Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. They haven't said what they want to replace it with. What might that look like in California?
Right, exactly. This, you know, what he'll replace it with has been very vague. One thing that Trump has said is that he wanted to switch Medicaid funding to be a block grant. So right now, and that would be a really big deal for California, because the biggest expansion under the Affordable Care Act has been in our Medi-Cal program. About a third of Californians are now covered by this, coverage for low-income people. And so that's going to be the big concern. If we go from, instead of a federal matching system, to a block grant, I think inevitably that's going to look like less federal funding for that program, which means that California might have to make some decisions about how to scale back the program.
And go ahead, Ray.
Well, for a lot of people who are listening to this program, they live in a state where companies have dropped out of the exchanges. Many have gone bankrupt. How has the Affordable Care Act worked in California? Are there a lot of people who are buying insurance under Obamacare?
California has definitely been the exception to the rule, partly because we're such a big state. We've had a more stable market, and so insurance companies have continued to participate. They've wanted to participate. This is not a market that they feel like they can walk away from. So that's definitely been different in California.
I want to bring in Marisa Lagos, who is our political reporter, one of our political reporters here at KQED. Marisa, there were gun control was on the ballot in California, Proposition 63, which I think did quite well. It was also on the ballot versions of gun control in other states, as well as the death penalty, too, in California, and then also Oklahoma, Nebraska. How did those issues fare tonight?
Yeah, so gun control was really a mixed bag. As you mentioned, California's Prop 63, which was the sort of most progressive measure on the ballot, so to speak, which would institute background checks and other regulations around ammunition sales, looks like it's headed for a very decisive win. However, in Nevada, a question about eliminating gun show loopholes is too close to call. Similar question in Maine appears to be losing. And in the state of Washington, they have approved a measure which was actually sort of modeled on a California law that would let courts take guns away or restrict access for folks who are deemed mentally unstable. So really mixed bag there. Death penalties not looking good for folks who wanted to repeal it in California. In Nebraska and Oklahoma, there were also measures that are going to either reinstate or sort of allow the death penalty to move forward. You know, there's been a lot of questions around execution methods and other
things. And of course, Prop 66 looked like it was going to pass. That will expedite executions, theoretically. We'll see how that works. Is that still leading?
It is, but it's pretty close, and we still have a lot of uncounted ballots, an estimated 3 million in California to go through on Wednesday, so we'll see how that works.
You're listening to special coverage from KQED and NPR News.
And this is Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 2:55. Good morning. Thanks for staying with us through election coverage in the overnight hours. Here's what we know in the state of Minnesota. Republicans had a strong showing in Minnesota on Election Day. Even though Donald Trump has declared victory, we still don't know if Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump has won Minnesota's 10 electoral votes. Trump won in all of Minnesota's neighboring states, Iowa, Wisconsin, and the Dakotas. As for congressional races here in the state of Minnesota, three U.S. House races are still too close to call. In the 1st District, DFL Congressman Tim Walz and challenger Jim Hagedorn are locked in a very tight race. In the 2nd District, we still don't know who will win the open seat there. Jason Lewis and Angie Craig are both vying to replace Republican retiring Republican John Klein. In the 8th District, the race between DFL Congressman Rick Nolan and challenger Stuart Mills is still very close, separated by 2 percentage points. As for the state legislature, Republicans appear to have retained control of the House of Representatives, and in fact, Democrats have conceded that. There's a chance the GOP could take control of the state Senate as well. Election results in Dakota County were delayed for hours after the polls closed last night. County Elections Manager Andy Loken says some city results were slow to arrive and election workers had to sort through large numbers of ballots from people who voted early.
The way that our system's programmed, we have to have every occurrence of a precinct, and that includes the absentee, the in-person, and the early voting occurrences of those precincts before we can report any part of that precinct. And so we're kind of stuck in this all-or-nothing situation.
As for a reaction to the Donald Trump win in the race for the White House, Minnesota DFL Congressman Keith Ellison says Democrats in Washington need to reinforce their identity with blue-collar voters. In yesterday's election, President-elect Trump made gains with those voters, especially amongst the white working class. Appearing on NPR last evening, Ellison said while Trump isn't a working class hero, the Democratic Party needs to keep fighting for that group of voters and the issues they're concerned about.
Over time, people really want to know, what are you going to do for them? Am I going to be able to retire? Can my kids go to college? Can I pay my rent?
Ellison cruised to victory in his bid for re-election in Minnesota's 5th congressional district. And Donald Trump's win thrilled his supporters in Minnesota. Mora businessman Seth Wellnights is a chair of the Kanabe County Republicans. He was looking forward to a Trump victory.
I'm extremely excited. I mean, you know, here we've got, you know, Donald Trump, who everybody in the media, I mean, from every level, has said that he has no chance of winning. And time again, he has represented the people and has represented a big concern in this country.
Hillary Clinton did not win as many votes as expected in Minnesota, particularly in rural areas. In two statewide matters, voters overwhelmingly approved the legislative pay amendment to the state constitution. An independent commission will be established to set legislator salaries, which have not been raised. since 1999. Also, incumbent Minnesota Supreme Court Justice Natalie Hudson defeated challenger Michelle McDonald. Brad Williams reports.
Hudson, who was appointed to the bench by Governor Dayton last year, will serve a six-year term on the bench. Throughout her campaign, Hudson has touted her experience and temperament. Before being appointed by the governor to replace retiring Justice Alan Page, Hudson sat on the bench of the State Appeals Court for 13 years. Hudson has also served as an Assistant Attorney General for the state of Minnesota, as St. Paul City Attorney, and as Assistant Dean at Hamline University School of Law. For Michelle McDonald, last night's loss was her second unsuccessful attempt to be elected to the state's highest court. In 2014, she was defeated by David Lillehog. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And at nprnews.org, you can follow all the live election results.
Support for news comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo is making changes to its retail banking division and is committed to taking actions to serve customers and their financial needs. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/commitment.
And this is Minnesota Public Radio News, 91.1 KNOW, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Listener-supported radio. More news anytime at nprnews.org. 40 degrees right now in the Twin Cities. For the rest of the overnight, it'll be partly cloudy, a low of 34 in some areas. Wednesday, tomorrow, or later today, rather, mostly sunny. Highs reaching the low 60s. Tonight, it'll be clear, a low near 43. Thursday, tomorrow, temperatures back in the 60s. Should be a very nice day. It'll be mostly sunny. Again, this is Minnesota Public Radio News. You're listening to special election coverage that will continue into the early morning hours ahead of Morning Edition. It's 3 o'clock.